When Superman reached an altitude of 12,000 feet, he stopped and looked back over his shoulder. All this talk about fathers. He thought back to the unconscious man he'd rescued earlier that day along the road in Alaska, the one who had reminded him so much of his father. The Man of Steel turned sharply back to the southwest and flew on until he came to a meandering tributary of the Elbow River. He descended to 5,000 feet and followed the river toward the twinkling lights of Smallville, then skirted around the west side of town and flew south to Hickory Lane. Diving down beneath the canopy of a grove of trees, he circled around to alight in the shadow of a newly painted barn. A quick glance toward the house with his X-ray vision confirmed that no strangers were in sight. Superman cut through the big kitchen and passed down the hall to the parlor. He stopped for a moment by a row of bookcases that lined the wall. His parents were both avid readers and had passed their love of books along to him. The Kent Family Library was an eclectic collection, holding everything from the collected works of Mark Twain and O. Henry to the latest bestsellers. One set of shelves housed his father's prized collection of Tom Swift books and science fiction pulps, while another held the Nancy Drew and Hardy Boys mysteries that his mother had inherited from a favorite aunt. Atop one shelf was a framed copy of the Paradoxical Commandments. Superman smiled. He had been a young boy when Jonathan Kent had brought this copy home. He remembered helping his father make the frame.
Words to live by, Clark. There will always be people who put you down despite the good you do. Whenever that happens, you just keep doing it anyway.
That's still good advice, Pa.
The caped man walked on, running his fingers along the familiar shelves. Near the end of the hall, something new caught his eye, and he paused before six books that sat apart from the others, framed by bookends, as if in a place of honor. Each bore the author's name, Clark Kent, on the spine.
Ma's rearranged a few things since my last visit.
He stuck his head into the parlor.
Hello?
Clark!
Hi, folks. Not interrupting anything, am I?
Not at all, dear. I was just checking my email.
Martha closed the little computer and got to her feet.
Jonathan, I told you I heard the back door open.
You should listen to her, Pa. Her hearing's almost as good as mine.
Huh? What'd you say?
Oh, Jonathan.
Well, hers is better than mine, that's for certain. Well, how are you, son?
Can't complain. Well, I could, but it wouldn't do any good.
Oh, you. You're as bad as your father. But it's so good to see you.
Yes, well, I was in the area, so I thought I'd drop by and see how my two favorite people in the whole world were doing.
Yeah, we're both in the pink, son. Got my cholesterol level down to 150, and of course, your ma gets prettier every day.
Johnny Kent, if you think that your line of malarkey will get you an extra slice of pie...
Pie? There's pie in the house?
Black raspberry, dear. Have you eaten at all today?
Oh, sure. The good people of Anchorage fed me quite well. But I'd never turn down a slice of black raspberry pie, especially tonight. I had a good all-terrain run this evening.
I see. Well, we have plenty of cold roast beef in the fridge, too. If you'd like some of that, I'll heat it up for you.
Now, don't go to a lot of trouble, Ma. I know you two eat early.
Nonsense. It's no trouble at all.
Martha took her son by the elbow and steered him back down the hall toward the kitchen.
It'll take no more than a minute or two in the microwave.
And I'll put a pot of coffee on.
Superman allowed his mother to lead him to the kitchen table.
Did you want two slices or three? I only ask because of the microwave. You know how it's been getting slower at cooking.
Oh, you don't need to bother with the microwave, Ma. I'll just heat it myself.
Oh, yes, I guess that would be faster.
Martha brought the roast over to the table, carved off two generous slices, and set them on a plate in front of him. Superman stared intently at the plate. In moments, the kitchen filled with the rich aroma of hot roast beef.
That sure does smell good. How about it, Martha?
Oh, all right. Another slice or two won't hurt your diet.
The three gathered around the kitchen table, Jonathan setting up plates, cups, and flatware, and Martha breaking out bread and condiments.
How is Lois, dear?
She's good, Ma. Busy, of course. She's been on the political beat lately.
Well, I hope you're finding some time for yourselves. I thank the stars that you and Lois finally came to your senses and got married.
Came to our senses?
Oh, as if you didn't know. You two used to get along like cats and dogs, even though you were both smitten with each other from the very day you met.
Oh, it was Superman that Lois was smitten with, Ma. She saw Clark Kent as nothing more than competition, at first. Fortunate, really. Otherwise, I'm sure she would have seen right through my disguise.
The important thing is that you were in love with each other. She's all you ever talked about. And it seemed to take ages for you to get together.
At least my double identity isn't coming between us anymore.
Thank heavens for that. You two had the loveliest ceremony.
Yeah, I'll second that, son. Most fun I ever had at a wedding. That wasn't my own. Hey, do you and Lois have any plans for your anniversary? It's coming up fast.
Oh, thanks for the reminder, Pa. I should try to surprise her with something special. More coffee, anyone?
Oh, let me do that, dear.
Oh, I can get it, Ma.
Well, we appreciate your stopping by after putting in such a busy day. Thank you, Clark. Just half a cup. I saw on the cable news how you and your super friends were helping all those poor souls in Alaska after the earthquake. And that horrible storm.
Thank you, son. That surely was a strange spell of weather. But then this has been a year for odd weather. There was a late snow just a few weeks ago down the Texas Panhandle. I haven't seen such extremes in the weather since back when you were born.
He shook his head and took off his glasses to polish them with his handkerchief. Superman held his coffee, thinking of the many times he'd seen his father perform that ritual, and of how Jonathan had changed over the years.
He's gotten older, but not old, thank God. I hope the man I rescued in Alaska can bounce back as well as Pa did.
The elder Kent had made a full recovery from a heart attack he had suffered a few years before, and was clearly taking better care of himself these days.
He's a good 15 pounds thinner than he was before the attack. He may grouse about the dieting, but he stayed with it.
What are you grinning about now?
Nothing in particular. It's just so good to see the two of you. Now, Ma, I believe you said something about pie?
1 hour and two large slabs of black raspberry pie, with a side of ice cream later, Superman kissed his parents goodbye, gave them one final wave, and leapt away from the steps of their back porch. Rocketing straight up into the sky, he leveled out at about 8,000 feet and again turned eastward. He soon left the plains of Kansas far behind him. As he neared the Mississippi River, he focused all his senses on the mighty waterway, half expecting a hurricane or waterspout to emerge out of nowhere. All was quiet, but he still looked back over his shoulder as he crossed southern Illinois into Kentucky. He shook his head. When he was feeling that paranoid, he knew it was time to go home. It was just an hour after midnight when Superman returned to Metropolis. It was a moonless night, but unseasonably cool, and the lights of the great city illuminated an ethereal fog wafting in off the harbor, creating an ambient glow that could be seen for miles in any direction. Superman picked up speed as he descended over downtown. Within moments, invisible to the human eye, he swooped low over a grand old apartment building at 1938 Sullivan Place and silently dropped down an all but forgotten air shaft. The shaft was the relic of an earlier, less air-conditioned era, and the windows that had once linked the building's apartments to it had been bricked over decades ago. But the Man of Steel had done a little work on the shaft since one particular newlywed couple had moved to the building. As he hovered in the cover of the shaft, one brick yielded to his touch and a secret passage swung open, admitting him to a darkened apartment on the upper floor. Superman padded silently down the hall, his boots barely touching the fine old hardwood floors. Halfway down the corridor, he suddenly met another, equally silent figure. The second figure first circled the Man of Steel, then arched its back as it rubbed up against his boots, nudging its head against his shins. Superman paused, reaching down to scratch a furry head between its ears.
Hi, Elroy. How's the mighty hunter tonight? I believe there's food in your bowl. Might even be tuna.
Elroy's ears pricked up at the sound of tuna, and he bounded away into the darkness. Superman continued down the hall to where a pale light outlined the edges of a door left slightly ajar. He found Lois Lane propped up in bed by two huge, overstuffed pillows. The late edition of the Daily Planet lay scattered on the floor, where it had fallen from her side of the king-sized bed. Lois was wearing an extra-extra-large Daily Planet t-shirt as a nightshirt, and the city light outside illuminated the room through a window. Superman stood stock still for a minute, just watching Lois's breath rise and fall.
I am so lucky to have found you.
Her right hand came up, cupping his jaw, and he lay his hand gently atop hers. As they broke off the kiss, she let her hand trail down to his chest and began tracing over the bold S insignia with her index finger.
Why, Superman, what would my husband say?
She glanced over at the empty spot on the bed beside her and made a game of looking under the pillows and covers.
Clark? Now where is that darned husband of mine anyway? Don't tell me he's out working late again.
I'll see if I can find him, Miss Lane.
He crossed the room and entered a big walk-in closet. He ran a finger along the underside of a shelf, and the back wall slid to one side, revealing a smaller, hidden alcove. He changed clothes, literally in the blink of an eye. One instant he was standing there in his familiar blue and red costume, and the next he was in his bare feet, wearing nothing more than a simple pair of gray cotton gym shorts. He set his boots far in the back of the secret alcove and draped the cape and suit over special racks, tucking them away neatly before sealing the wall shut. Then he slid the hangered garments back into place and let his hands fall to his side. The man of tomorrow stood with his head slightly bowed, just breathing deeply. Beginning with his neck and shoulders, he first deliberately tensed and then consciously relaxed each muscle group. From head to toe, he let his entire musculoskeletal system loosen up, settle in, and settle down as well. In less than a minute, the commanding physical presence he projected as the Man of Steel eased into the milder, more comfortable body language of a man of flesh and bone. Even the contours of his face changed. He wasn't slouching by any means. His posture was still excellent, another of the many good habits his parents had instilled in him. But he now stood several inches shorter, and his shoulder span was narrower. He combed a hand back through his hair and squinted in the darkness, tensing certain optic muscles to slightly change the focus of his eyes. He slipped on his wedding band, and then, from long habit, Clark Kent put on his glasses.
Ah, Lois.
Well, there you are. I haven't seen you all day. In fact, I haven't seen you in 2 whole days. Do you know what time it is?
Sorry, I'm late, hon. I was off chasing down a big story.
Oh, I don't doubt that. Always trying to scoop me, aren't you, Kent?
Only like this.
Hey, oh!
What's that, ma'am? Can't quite hear you for all the giggling. Was there something you wanted me to stop doing?
No.
She lifted his glasses off the bridge of his nose and wrapped her arms around his shoulders.
Not anymore.
Missed you.
Same here. Let's go to bed, Smallville.
I should probably brush my teeth.
Lois took his hand and pulled him toward her.
That can wait.
Out in the Atlantic, the tiny one-man submersible silently drifted beneath a freighter at anchor. As it inched past the anchor chain, a claw-like device popped out from the side of the little craft, grabbing hold of one of the links. As soon as it locked onto the chain, the dark figure of the Batman emerged from the submersible, a slender air tank strapped to his chest. The Dark Knight kicked off from his craft, following the chain up through the inky waters. He slipped under the keel of the freighter and moved along its hull just below the water level. Finding a cluster of barnacles stuck tightly to the hull, he loosened the straps of his air tank and slipped out of them. He then clamped the tank fast to the barnacles, took one last deep breath, and shut it off. The Batman's head broke the surface, water sluicing off the horn-like ears of his cowl. He stretched up one hand, gaining purchase on the hull with a gripping pad covered with millions of microscale polyester hairs. Modeled after the feet of the gecko lizard, it held fast as the Dark Knight pulled himself up from the ocean. With similar gecko pads in his other hand and fastened to his boots, he quickly made his way up the side of the ship. In minutes, he swung his feet onto the deck of the freighter and disappeared into the shadows beneath an array of booms and cranes. Tying off a line, he dropped into the first of the forward cargo holds. Night vision lenses within his mask clicked into place, and the chamber became as bright as day to him. He quickly surveyed the hold, missing nothing, and moved on. In the third cargo hold, the Batman finally found the containers he'd been tracking since Butron. He inspected them carefully, poring over every inch with a full-spectrum light from his utility belt until he was satisfied that they'd not been opened or otherwise tampered with since leaving Cape Verde. Then he checked out the rest of the hold's contents. Stowed alongside the Venom containers were a series of crates full of clear plastic ovoids, each about the size of a small melon. They looked like toys, like children's playthings, and they looked so out of place that he snapped off a few pictures of the things with a miniature camera. He had just resealed the crate when the lights came on. The Batman was momentarily blinded and caught out in the open as the crewmen flooded into the hold. There was nowhere for him to hide now, and there were six of them. In seconds, three men were down, but the others had pulled daggers. The blades did them no good. The Dark Knight disarmed the first man and swung him around into the next one. With both men stunned from the impact, Batman turned to the last man and threw the captured dagger. The dagger hit the man killed first, knocking him out. The man that Batman had disarmed pushed himself up with one hand.
Hail, Nadja!
He clenched his jaw tight and collapsed into convulsions. In an instant, the Batman was at his side, pulling an auto-injector from his utility belt.
Your puny serums will not long stay my sacrifice. Infidel, my master is ever one step ahead of you. I will tell you nothing. Nadja.
For just a moment, the Batman's hands clenched tightly into fists, and his lips mouthed a silent curse. Then he turned to the five remaining unconscious men and swiftly relieved them of their own poison pills. A quick search revealed that all of them bore a cryptic, cobra-headed tattoo on their left shoulders. He bound and gagged them, then exited the hold. There was no time to lose. Six men would soon be missed. The Dark Knight swept through the ship, pausing only to shut down alarms and surveillance systems. One by one, the lights winked out below decks. The crewman in his path were rendered unconscious, and a series of gas grenades tossed into vent shafts ensured that sleeping crewmen kept on sleeping. Finally, there were only two left. He found the captain in the freighter's radio room.
100 men on guard and not one answers my call!
Why? The master is counting on us! Santos, where are they?
Open your mouth. There, you won't get to die. Lucky you.
Behind Batman, the first mate he'd stunned with his batarang pulled himself up to the radio console. Holding his breath, he reached for a switch, his hand trembling. The Dark Knight spun on the ball of one foot.
Too late, Batman. My first mate accomplished his task. You have walked into our trap!
If this is a trap, then you're caught in it as well. Your master cannot save you. Your crew cannot save you. Even if you had help waiting just beyond the horizon, and you don't, you'd arrive far too late to do you any good. Now, what is your master planning?
You're dead.
The captain flinched, startled by the abrupt change in conditions, and his defiance shaken. The Batman was startled as well, but didn't show it. He dragged the captain from the radio room and onto the outer deck. A cloudless night sky had given way to a violent storm.
Truly, this must be the work of the Most Holy. No one is beyond his reach, Dark One! You can overcome mere men, but you cannot defeat nature!
A huge wave surged over the deck, tearing the captain from Batman's grasp. Batman himself was thrown against a bulkhead. He could feel a couple of his ribs crack. Clutching a cable that hung from a free-swinging boom, he hauled himself painfully to his feet. The captain scrambled to an upper deck and dropped to his knees, raising his arms high as if in prayer.
Hail to thee, mighty Nadja! Nadja! Our Lord the Master! We deliver unto you your enemy! Gladly we sacrifice ourselves to your greater glory! There shall be a new dawn!
bolt of lightning silenced the captain's ravings. So bright was the strike that the Batman had to look away. But for an instant, he swore that he could see the man's skeleton standing black against the blinding light. Through a haze of pain, the Batman clenched the muscles of his jaw, and a tiny microphone snaked out of the lining of his mask, stopping close in front of his lips.
Mayday! Mayday! This is a Code A emergency. Do you copy?
Batman, this is Pete Adams. Come again?
Repeat. Mayday. Does anyone copy?
I barely hear you, Batman. Are you saying?
Damn it! Too much interference from...
Suddenly, there came an ominous flash from below decks as some spilled fuel caught fire.
Time to bail.
Gritting his teeth, he leapt over the side. He hit the water hard, his broken ribs scraping together. Fighting the pain, he dove straight down. There was no time to retrieve his tank from the hole now. He had to reach the submersible, reach the bigger tanks there. Behind and above him, the fire reached the ship's fuel tanks. 60 feet down, a shockwave slammed into the Batman, all but knocking the wind out of him. And then, all went dark, both above and below the waves. In his secret lair, the monitors of the man who called himself Adam showed multiple views of a vast section of the Atlantic Ocean, ranging from the equator to the Tropic of Cancer, and from mid-ocean to the Gulf of Mexico. But his main attention was on a screen showing a raging storm swirling on the edge of South America's continental shelf. In the heart of that storm, a global positioning beacon had just shut down. He cupped his hand around his headset's microphone.
Step back from stage two, Mark. Relax. Let the storm die out.
In minutes, the swirling patterns faded from the screen. Adam punched up new views from two spy satellites and checked a dozen different readings, looking for any signs of the freighter. He could find none. The ship had vanished from the face of the Earth.
Mark? Mark, can you hear me?
Hmm?
Mark, tell me where you are.
Here. Right here, Sahib. I'm in the zone.
That's good, Mark. You've done very well. Just stay where you are. We have one more mission today, and then you can rest.
Whatever you say.
Adam muted his mic and smiled.
The freighter is gone and the Batman with it. And with that accursed detective gone, we should have little trouble dealing with the rest of the Justice League.
Shortly before dawn, Clark Kent awoke and his eyes tracked to his left. There, Lois still lay snuggled up close to him, her head resting against his shoulder. Clark slowly slipped his shoulder out from under his sleeping wife, gingerly easing her head down onto the pillow. Clark shifted over on his side, turning toward her, and Lois opened her eyes.
Oh, sorry. Didn't mean to wake you.
That's okay. Morning, good-looking.
Morning, beauty.
Beauty? I wish.
Lois pushed herself up into a sitting position and ran a hand through her hair. One stubborn strand kept falling across her face.
I know what I must look like. Classic bed hair, right?
You always look good to me.
And you always know the right thing to say. Do you have to go anywhere?
Not just now, no. Still, shouldn't you be catching some shut-eye? I can get by on 2 or 3 hours a night, but you need your sleep.
I can rest later. Besides, I'm more thirsty than sleepy.
You want a glass of water?
Yes. No, wait. How about some orange juice? A big glass would really hit the spot.
Here you are.
You know, we've been married almost 2 years, and I'm still not used to that. But I like it. Freshly squeezed.
Only the best for you.
And you're sure you don't have to go?
Yep, not so much as a single car alarm in earshot.
That's good. Because I never did get a chance to ask you how your day went.
Probably not too much to tell you that you don't already know from the wire services. Superman stopped a contract hit in Federal Plaza and apprehended the gunman. Then he flew up to Alaska to join the rest of the Justice League in assisting with emergency rescue from an earthquake, and we were just getting things under control when a typhoon, or something like one, blew in, and we had to deal with that. Aside from stopping a hold-up man on the way home, that was it for Superman. Oh, and I dropped in to check on the folks. They both send their love.
Oh, that's nice. Sounds like your day was busier than mine.
Yeah.
Something bothering you?
I don't know. It's been a lot of crazy weather lately. I know these things come in cycles, but there was something unnatural about how that typhoon struck. It was as if someone had engineered that storm. No one saw it coming. Not the National Weather Service, not the Navy forecasters, no one.
Well, meteorology isn't an exact science, Clark. They can't catch them all. The important thing is that you and the League were there to deal with it.
I guess you're right. So, how was your day? I believe you were going down to D.C.?
I was, and I did. Interviewed Senator Price about her new Oceanic Wildlife Bill. Stopped by the Pentagon, where I was able to pump some old contacts about the Air Force's planned satellite recovery program. Caught the shuttle back in time to file my stories and catch a late dinner at Dooley's with Fran and Louise. Then I came home to wait up for my sexy husband. Speaking of whom, how did the planet's ace reporter spend his day?
Who, moi?
I ask because when Perry White asks about the elusive Mr. Kent, I want to have my story straight.
Ah, good point. Yours truly managed to temporarily evade the wrath of his editors, I hope, by leaving a couple of phone messages from the field. I assured all concerned that the new crime exposé was on track, and that I'd have my copy in soon.
And will you?
Pending any further catastrophes, I should. The first two installments are already composed, and I have rough notes on the rest. At this point, all I need to do is find a few spare minutes to spend at a keyboard.
A few minutes? Well, thank you, Speedy. When I think of all the thousands of hours I've spent sweating over keyboards...
And your writing is all the better for it. Of the two of us, who's received more awards for journalism?
All right, I have.
Uh-huh. And who won an Edgar for her mystery novel?
I did.
Look at it this way, Lois. It takes someone with superpowers just to keep up with you.
You always know the right thing to say.
Just one of my many gifts.
Lois slid back on one elbow, tucking her legs behind her and looking her husband over, as if seeing him for the first time.
What's wrong, Lois? Do I have something caught in my teeth?
No, nothing. You simply fascinate me, that's all.
I do. Well, you do too. Fascinate me, I mean. I love you.
I love you too. And I love that you're still so modest. I look at you sometimes and I just can't believe that you're real and that you're here.
She slowly ran her index finger up the length of his arm.
Clark, what's it like, flying?
Come on, Lois. You've flown with me hundreds of times.
That's just it. I've flown with you, but I can't fly on my own like you can. I know I've asked you before, but tell me again. What is it like to be able to fly?
It's fun. It's the most incredible sensation. I have to confess, when I'm not flying to an emergency, I like to do aerobatics. I indulged in a few loops and barrel rolls on the way home last night. I love to fly over the middle Atlantic states just a few thousand feet. It really does look like a crazy quilt at that altitude. The woods, the villages, farmlands and cities, roads and rivers. I never get tired of it. It's an amazing sight.
I'm sure it is. I'm so envious. But the act of flying itself, what does that feel like?
Ah, how do I explain? Well, it's kind of simple, really. First, you crouch down a bit. Sometimes I'll take a couple of running steps, and you flex your muscles. The quadriceps and the hamstrings are important here. Then you just leap into the air and keep on going.
Oh, you.
Hey, I thought I fascinated.
Trouble?
Possibly. Coast Guard emergency klaxon. Priority code.
He stared out through the south wall and beyond.
There's a cutter about 6 miles out and a mile down the shore. And a lot of fog rolling in. This might be nothing, but...
Nothing? On a priority code? Not likely. Sounds more like a story in the making. Go, I'll catch up with you later.
Right.
There was a swirl of air, and in the next moment, Lois found herself in the embrace of Superman.
Maybe we can get together for lunch?
Yes, Oh, no, darn. Today I'm supposed to cover the governor's conference at the Civic Center.
Dinner, then. If I'm not back at the city room before 5, I'll leave a message on your voicemail. Love you.
Sure, I... Love you.
Lois ran to the window, just in time to see the soaring caped form heading out to sea. She stayed there by the window until he was gone from sight.
Old Salt calling Young Salt, come in. Old Salt to Young Salt, come in, Young Salt.
Alfred Pennyworth steered the catamaran in circles around the spot where the freighter had gone down. Pieces of flotsam, most of them frightfully small, bobbed amid the waves, the only indication that there had recently been a ship in the area. From the catamaran's original position, Alfred had watched the storm suddenly boil up just over the horizon. He'd heard the thunder and seen the flashes, first of lightning and then of the explosion. When the freighter's GPS beacon disappeared from his monitor, Alfred had immediately fired up the engines and headed directly into the storm. With the ocean roiling around him, he'd broken radio silence and disregarded every other order he'd been given. Alfred had every confidence in the Batman's abilities, but the forces of nature trumped everything, and as far as he was concerned, voided all agreements. By the time he'd reached the site, the skies were again clear and the sea calm. There was no longer any storm, no sign of the freighter, and no sign of the Batman. Nor had the dawn brought any new revelations. By now, the submersible's air supply would surely have been exhausted, but Alfred kept searching. He had served the Wayne family for decades, as had his father before him, and he refused to abandon their last son now. Alfred Pennyworth had first come to work for Thomas and Martha Wayne shortly after the death of his father. Though his first love had been the theater, he had assumed his position as the Wayne's butler out of familial duty. And that sense of duty only deepened when the Waynes were murdered by a holdup man. The death of the Waynes had changed Bruce forever. He became driven to learn and excel. Through long years of arduous study and exercise, he built himself into the epitome of mental and physical strength. On the day that Bruce became the master of Wayne Manor, he confided in Pennyworth his secret plan. He would use his skills and knowledge to wage war on the criminal element that had killed his parents. Unable to dissuade the young man, Alfred did the only thing he could do. He became an aide and confidant to the Batman. But now, he was running out of options. There were additional scuba tanks aboard, and he knew how to dive. He could search, but for what? And what if he encountered trouble below? The ocean stretched out in all directions around him, and he suddenly felt very alone. Perhaps he should call for assistance, but from whom? Superman? Or one of the Batman's other Justice League allies? Alfred was switching radio frequencies when he noticed a strange rhythmic movement along the horizon to the east.
What's this?
He focused his binoculars on the area and saw a dolphin. No, there were two of them. And behind them, Alfred's heart leapt to his throat. The dolphins were towing the submersible, and balanced effortlessly on the tiny craft was a tall blonde man dressed in green and gold.
My word. Aquaman!
Alfred spun the wheel, turning the catamaran in the direction of the approaching dolphins, and let out the throttle, rapidly closing the distance between them. He brought the ship's stern about and killed the engine as the dolphin swam up between the twin hulls. The Sea King raised an arm in greeting.
Ahoy the ship! Are you the Old Salt?
Yes, yes, I am!
The plexiglass of the submersible was cracked and scored, making it difficult to see within.
He's
alive! And while not in the bloom of health, I'd say that he's at least still capable of recovery.
Aquaman popped open the canopy and gently picked up the dark-clad form within. He carefully slid the Batman onto the canopy and lifted it onto the back deck of the catamaran.
Be careful with him. At the very least, he has a couple of cracked ribs.
No, no painkillers. I need to stay alert.
Far be it from me, sir, to interfere with your more masochistic tendencies.
Alfred produced a pair of scissors, cutting away the Dark Knight's jersey and easing off the Kevlar vest beneath.
A fine new set of bruises. Shall I photograph these for your memory book?
Just tape me up.
Yeah, let me check for breaks first.
He gently felt his way along the Batman's ribcage, noting when the Dark Knight flinched.
Not as bad as it first looked. You do lead a charmed life, don't you?
Lucky me.
I should say so. In case you haven't noticed, it's a big ocean out here. If I hadn't been in the region, or if I had been a mile further away, I might not have noticed the storm. It caught my attention, and I swam in to check it out. Otherwise, I probably wouldn't have been close enough to pick up your distress call.
Distress call?
I'm not as suicidal as you think.
But, sir, I heard nothing.
I didn't use our frequency, Alfred. I didn't want you drawn into that storm. I used my Justice League transceiver, but I couldn't raise the watchtower.
Not too surprising. That freak storm probably caused a lot of interference.
Yes. No doubt that was by design.
I beg your pardon?
There was nothing natural about that storm.
The Batman put a hand on Aquaman's shoulder and painfully pulled himself up into a seated position.
It blew up out of a clear sky and reached full fury just minutes after the freighter's radio operator sent a message that I was trapped. That storm was artificially generated. It aimed right at me.
But how?
And by whom?
That I already know. He's one of the most dangerous men alive. We've both been on the receiving end of his schemes, Arthur. Remember Portugal?
The Nadja Nadja.
None other. How he did this, I haven't a clue. But I intend to find out.
If you need any help stopping him, I'm here for you.
Thank you, Arthur.
The Batman gripped Aquaman's hand as Alfred pulled the tape tight over his injured ribs.
I'm sure we'll be needing you before this is over. But for now, I'd appreciate your help in keeping this incident quiet.
If you say so. But why?
The Nadja Nadja brewed up a storm, destroying a freighter and everyone aboard. He sacrificed a ship full of his own men in an attempt to kill me. For now, let's let him think he succeeded. Maybe he'll get sloppy.
Dawn was inexplicably turning from pink to gray as Superman flew out over the ocean. Within seconds, he was enshrouded in a thick fog bank. So dense was the fog that it seemed as though the night was returning to the mid-Atlantic. Only the sound of the klaxon and the heat signature of the Coast Guard cutter, visible to the Man of Tomorrow's extraordinary eyes, enabled him to find the ship. Two Coast Guardsmen were feeling their way along the deck like blind men when Superman landed on the cutter. He led them below decks and made his way to the bridge. The cutter's commander was pacing the control cabin when the Man of Steel entered.
Superman! Good to see you.
How can I be of help?
The commander waved the Man of Steel over to a greenlit display.
All right, here's what we got. We have half a dozen small to medium-sized craft caught out in this mess, and at least one full-size ocean liner. Visibility is virtually zero. I'm a career man, and I have never seen a fog this thick. Never. Thanks to our instruments, radar, sonar, radio triangulation, we have a good idea where the ships are, but we're having a hard time rendering any aid. We tried firing flares, but that's done no good. The fog swallowed up their light almost immediately, and there's a danger of collision even if we try an instrument approach.
The radioman looked up from his headphones.
Skipper, we already have a collision. A tanker's just reported hitting a small cabin cruiser about 2 kilometers due north. No damage to the tanker, but the cruiser's taking on water.
Sounds as though that's the most urgent case, Commander. I'll do everything I can, but warn all ships to hold their positions.
Will do, Superman.
Getting a fix on the location of the collision, Superman headed back out into the fog, reaching the site in moments. The tanker had a searchlight pointed down at the cabin cruiser and was trying to drop it a line, but the smaller craft was already listing badly to one side. The Man of Steel flew low over the damaged ship. In the gloom of the fog, only the vaguest of shapes were visible, but his eyes could see the infrared silhouettes of 3 people hanging onto the wheel for dear life. He flew in close enough for them to see him.
Ahoy there!
Who? Is it really?
It is! I'm Superman!
Superman! Oh, thank God you're here!
Don't worry. Everything's going to be okay. Radio the Coast Guard that I've arrived and that we'll soon be underway.
Superman dove underwater, putting his back to the keel of the ship. Rising up, he broke free of the ocean with a small craft carefully balanced on his back. Getting his bearings, he turned about and flew west. As he neared the city, the air began to lighten around them. Suddenly, they broke out into a clear sky, the port of Metropolis just a few miles ahead. A minute later, Superman lowered the boat into a repair berth at the local Coast Guard station. As Coast Guard medics rushed to help the people from their boat, the Man of Steel came up from beneath the craft.
Tow lines! I need at least 6, as thick and heavy as you can give me.
guardsmen jumped to comply, and in moments, Superman rocketed back out to sea, the heavy lines slung over his shoulders.
Good morning, and welcome to AM Metropolis for Friday, June 18th.
On the 20th floor of the Daily Planet building, early risers were starting to filter into the offices of Metropolis's leading newspaper. The big double doors of the Planet City room swung open as a freckle-faced man shouldered his way through. He looked almost young enough to still be delivering papers in the suburbs, but a press pass hung from a lanyard around his neck. The young man strode across the room, doffing his baseball cap to release an unruly shock of red hair.
"What's up, Chief?"
Perry White glanced down from the wall-mounted television monitor that held his attention.
"Come see for yourself, Olsen."
"Oh, checking out the competition. Hey, Superman, cool. What's he pulling?"
"See for yourself."
"We are continuing coverage of this live GBS exclusive, Rescue at Sea. I'm Stephen Benjamin. For those of you just joining us, we are miles outside of Metropolis Harbor where, at this hour, Superman is single-handedly towing a line of ships that became lost this morning in a gigantic fog bank that now stretches along a third of the Atlantic seaboard."
The camera panned past Superman, along the cable to the big ocean liner, and continued on. Another cable stretched from the stern of the liner to the bow of an ocean-going tanker, and a third line stretched from the tanker off into the fog.
"The Coast Guard now reports that the Queen Mary II briefly powered up, which means that Superman did not start with the vessel absolutely dead in the water. But even so, this is a stupendously amazing sight. According to the Guard, the Man of Steel is towing at least half a dozen ships bound for the port of Metropolis. That's all for now. Back to you at the studio, Rick."
"Whoa, six ships? That's a lot of tonnage. Hey, Chief, you want me to get down to the harbor? We should get some photos of this."
"Oh, do you really think so, Olsen?"
"Well, I just..."
Yes, of course! Get down there on a double! Can't beat the damn boob tube for immediacy, but if we hustle, we can add some depth to the story in time for the afternoon edition. Let me turn this damn thing down. Come on, people! Let's get on the story! Wit, I want the specifics on every one of those ships. Everything from tonnage to ports of call. Fran, Danny, head down to the docks and interview the passengers and crew from that liner. Sal, give me some quotes from the Coast Guard. Where in blazes is Clark Kent?"
"Out working on the Intergang story, remember?"
A short, round-faced young woman handed White a short stack of papers.
"He called twice yesterday. The top two messages are from him, and he's promised to have copy in by this afternoon."
"Oh, yeah. Thank you, Allie. Well, that explains what Ken is up to, but where the devil is Lois?"
"Line one."
Just a few blocks away, Lois stood at a street corner, one hand clutching the early edition of the Planet and a large coffee, the other holding her cell phone to one ear.
"Yes, I know all about it, Perry. The coffee shop had AM Metropolis on when I stopped in. Just a minute. Taxi!" "Yes, I know. I'll be..." "Oh, wow, that was quick. Just one moment, Chief. Pier 7, step on it."
"Ah, Ms. Lane, I thought that was you."
"You're Bali, right? You've picked me up, what, 3 times in the past month and at all hours of the day or night. Don't you ever sleep either?"
"Ah, my lovely wife Matrika and I are expecting our first child. We need to feather the nest. And I have found that the fares in this neighborhood are most generous. Such as the one you are giving me right now. Pier 7 it is."
"Okay, I'm back. What? Yes, I know the captain of the QM2. Relax, Perry. I'm headed for the docks now. What, Fran and Danny? Sure, I'll keep an eye out for them. Chief? Better warn them to pack umbrellas. We're in for more precip today. Later."
"Oh, you have an umbrella, Miss Lane?"
"I do. I never leave the house without my reporter's package. Recorder, press pass, PDA, breath mints."
"I hope it will be enough, Miss Lane."
Bali switched on his headlights and wipers as the rain sluiced over the cab. The cabbie lightly tapped his anti-lock brakes, hydroplaning only slightly as he made a right onto 27th Street. Lois stared ahead through the spotless plexiglass at the windshield beyond, watching the rain distort the morning traffic after each pass of the wipers.
"I think those are the biggest raindrops I've ever seen. Lovely weather if you have gills. I've lived in Metropolis half my life, but I've never gotten used to how changeable the climate can be here.
You can certainly say that again.
Lois continued to stare out the window at pedestrians running for the cover of awnings and doorways. The weather had been crazy lately, but engineered? Who in their right mind would ever add to this magnificent chaos? By 11:45 a.m., the worst of the storm front seemed to have passed. But after 4 hours of dealing with ships, flooding, and resultant power outages, Superman was still a long way from calling it a morning. Flying over downtown Metropolis, he shot past the 96-story LexCorp Tower and climbed high into the concealment of a passing cloud bank. Then he turned and dove, faster than the eye could follow, toward the great golden globe that topped the Daily Planet building. Entering via an access port on the underside of the sphere, Superman dropped rapidly down a back stairwell. After a decade of working for the paper, he knew every nook and cranny of the great building. Using his speed and super senses to evade detection, he zipped into the locker room of the small health club on the 15th floor that the Daily Planet's owners maintained for staff and management. He had caught a quick shower, changed into his street clothes, and reclaimed a laptop computer from his locker, all before the regulars started arriving for their noontime aerobics class. Back up the stairs, Clark Kent entered the city room by a rear door, checking for an empty office. As he'd hoped, Mary Powers had already left for lunch. Clark ducked into the feature editor's office, locking the door and closing the blinds behind him. He sat down in a side chair and waited for his laptop to boot up.
Here we go.
Ah, this looks like a good hoagie.
Dining in again, Chief?
Cut! About time you showed up. What do you have for me?
My first two in-depths on the Intergang case and an outline of the remainder, just so you'll know where it's going. It's all emailed to your computer. I should have the rest finished over the weekend. Oh, and since I know you like to have a hard copy to read over, there's one printing out now.
Good opening. Nice hook. I don't know how you do it sometimes, Kent.
Thanks, Perry. I had a good teacher. You were getting the great stories and scooping the competition when I was still learning to conjugate verbs.
Well, maybe so. But even on my best days, I was never as quick at turning copy out as you are. I've been in the newspaper business for 40 years, and you have to be the fastest typist I have ever known. And never a single typo.
Spell checkers do make that easier these days.
Spell checkers? Those things are just smart enough to get you into trouble. I've yet to see one that could replace a good proofreader. The latest upgrade that's been foisted upon us has been adding typos. If you ask me... Just a minute, Kent. Hello? White speaking. What? Son of a... Yes, hang on! Copy desk? I have Solnier on line 2. She's out in North Baker line at... Listen, damn it! I don't care if it is your lunch break! This is big! The storm's weakened the locks on the barge canal and they're about to give way! You can eat later! Get ready to take her feed and get a photog out there. If you can't find Olsen, send Levin or Jaworski. Whew, what a day. One damn thing after another, eh, Kent? Kent?
The Man of Steel swooped low over Metropolis Harbor, picking up speed as he shot past the sprawling warehouse district of the northern borough. But he was still over a mile from the Carter River Industrial Canal when the lower gates of lock number 1 collapsed.
No.
A wall of water poured from the sundered lock, hurling a waiting coal barge backward as though it were a child's toy. The 100-ton barge slammed into a massive concrete pier. One side tipped high up into the air as the other slid beneath the churning waters. Two men tumbled from the barge's pilot house, rolling down the tilted craft toward the rushing torrent. But before they could hit the water, a strong arm wrapped around each man, and a caped figure pulled them up into the sky.
Superman!
Yes, you're going to be all right. Was anyone else aboard the barge?
The Man of Steel set the two down on an adjacent service road.
Oh no, Sarah. A large crew isn't required on the canal. It's supposed to be a simple piloting job. I wouldn't have thought it was possible for a barge to sink that fast. Oh my God! The pier!
Superman followed the man's gaze. The concrete pillar that their barge had struck formed the eastern support of the old coastline railway bridge. But now, great cracks opened in that pillar, and it pitched nearly 10 degrees to the west.
Stay here. Help should arrive soon.
Superman saw the Metro Superliner fast approaching, and he knew that even if the engineer hit the brakes at that very moment, it would be too late. Momentum would carry the train onto a structure that could no longer support its weight. He dove under the bridge. There was a growing gap between the sagging pillar and the steel beams that had rested upon it just seconds before. Superman threw himself into that gap, bracing the underside of the roadbed with his own back and shoulders. Beneath him, the concrete pier shuddered and dropped another inch. The pillar was sinking more and more. Superman could feel the strain building in the steel beams at his back. He pushed up to ease that strain, and the pillar shifted yet again. Then came the crushing pressure as the multi-ton engine reached the bridge. Above him, he could feel the high-speed locomotive clear the bridge, then the next car, and the next. Superman knew the schedule of the bullet train, knew that it would be full of people, some heading out of town on business, others perhaps setting out early for a long weekend, knew that all of those lives were literally riding on his shoulders.
Superman! Is that you down there?
Yes.
Superman peered up between the overhead trusses to see a railroad maintenance worker shining a light down at him.
A couple of transit cops found the canal jockeys you rescued. They said that... Oh, jeez! Are you holding the bridge up by yourself?
One end of it. But I'd rather not make a career of this.
Okay. Just hold on. Yeah, affirmative on that pier impact. We need a crane and reinforcement beams down here on the double. Superman, can you hang in there another 10, 15 minutes?
That would be a short enough career. Can you guarantee there won't be any more trains along in that time?
Yes, sir. All traffic's been diverted to alternate tracks.
Then I can easily hang in here.
Rain continued intermittently along the entire eastern seaboard for the rest of the day, but only Metropolis was truly hammered by the storm. There, the downpour lasted until long past midnight. The deluge finally stopped by the time a special edition of the Daily Planet started rolling off the presses. The storm clouds began to thin shortly after the last bulk delivery of Saturday's Planet, and there were actually hints of sunshine by the time that home subscribers picked up their papers. People kept glancing outdoors, astonished that they could read the paper by natural daylight. And there was plenty to read. The report on the collapse of Lock Number 1 shared space on page 1 of the Saturday edition, with news and features on the harbor rescues. In a special feature by Lois Lane, ship's captains and crews gave readers a glimpse of how they coped, minute by minute, with the suffocating fog. By mid-morning Saturday, the hills and higher ground in Metropolis were bone dry. The sky stayed only partly sunny at best, and clouds occasionally threatened more rain, but no further precipitation fell. In low-lying areas, residents and merchants assessed the flood damage and began the cleanup. The next morning brought Metropolis a true Sunday, with clear blue skies and glorious sunshine that lasted all day long. Even in the areas hardest hit by the storm, little block parties spontaneously broke out as people took time from shoveling mud and bailing out their basements. Sunday's Daily Planet featured updates on the storm's aftermath, as well as suggestions for how ordinary citizens could help. On Monday's edition of AM Metropolis, Rick and Kelly had dozens of weather-related human interest stories for their audience, including their own interview with the captain of the QM2. By mid-afternoon on Monday, under the second day in a row of clear, sunny skies, Metropolis started returning to something approaching normal. There was a feeling that a corner had been turned. So people went back to work and helped their friends and neighbors and told themselves that everything was going to be all right. For most of the city, the Great Storm was already becoming the stuff of instant books, news archives, and insurance claims. And across the globe, after 2 days of rest, Mark went back to work as well. Tuesday morning, Wonder Woman brought her plane to a halt 40,000 feet above the eastern outskirts of Gateway City, California. Giving the craft a silent command to stay out of the local air lanes, she popped the canopy and dove down toward the sprawling West Coast Metroplex. It had been well over a year since the Amazon Warrior had lived in the area, Then, Diana had worked as a special advisor and visiting lecturer on Greco-Roman mythology, working closely with Helena Sandsmark, the curator of the city's Museum of Cultural Antiquities. But in recent months, she had been named her native land's ambassador to the United Nations, necessitating a move to Themyscira's New York embassy. Now, a special UN-sponsored symposium on preserving the world's ancient artifacts was bringing her back to the museum once more. On the east steps of the museum, a gathering of dignitaries awaited her arrival, their numbers dwarfed by the media and a huge crowd of the curious. Television cameras picked up her approach from the east. She could see people with signs celebrating her arrival. But as the Amazon descended over the park across from the museum grounds, she could see the black clouds build and thicken in the west. She could feel an unseasonably cold wind roaring in off the Pacific. And then, the heavens seemed to shatter and fall. Fist-sized hail slammed into the glass facades of the high-rise office buildings just north of the museum.
Hera!
Wonder Woman looked back toward the crowd. Police on the scene had started herding people under the building's east portico as broken glass and more hail began hitting the pavement nearby. Wonder Woman soared up into the heart of the storm. She closed her eyes and gave a silent command. Her plane kept going and swooped over Gateway City. At Wonder Woman's mental command, the plane flattened out, morphing into a giant flying shield that hovered protectively over the urban center, hail shattering against its nearly transparent surface. Diana flew up under her shield, directing it into the heart of the hailstorm. The Amazon warrior didn't know how long this onslaught would last, but she was determined to protect as much of the city and as many of its people as she could. But as Wonder Woman steered her flying shield north to ward off the barrage of hail, the storm struck a mile to the south. A powerful bolt of lightning struck one of the city's tallest skyscrapers. The Amazon looked back, just in time to see the 20-foot communications tower topple over the side of the building.
No!
Diana spun around and shot across the sky, leaving the shield to follow the hail. By the time she reached the building, the tower was a deadly missile, already a third of the way to the street below, where dozens of cars sat stuck in traffic. Wonder Woman dove under the plummeting tower, matched speeds with it, and grabbed hold midway along its length. Her fingers sank deep into the metal tower as she strained to stop its fall without snapping it in two.
Demeter, give me strength!
The tower's momentum carried them both down another 15 stories.
Hermes, speed my flight!
But after another 10, they were dropping half as rapidly. That speed was cut again by half with the next 10 stories and the next. 12 feet above the city streets, Wonder Woman brought the tower to a halt. Slowly, the Amazon turned, delicately balancing the tower overhead. She flew around the corner of the skyscraper to a plaza.
Please, give me room!
The handful of pedestrians and sidewalk vendors who had ventured back out as the hailstorm moved north now rushed to get out of her way. Not until she was certain that everyone was safely clear of the area did Wonder Woman land on the plaza. And then, the skies above lightened. Her eyes narrowed.
Superman was right. There is nothing natural about this storm.
One time zone to the east, in Lakewood, Colorado, a tall man in a black suit and dark glasses stood beneath the shadow of an awning, the first in a line of people patiently waiting for a soft-serve ice cream stand to open. The sun burned hot and bright in a cloudless sky, and he loosened his tie a quarter inch.
All right, we're open for business. All morning, Mr. Jones. How's my best customer? Detective business keeping you busy?
Let's just say it's keeping the bills paid, Arnie.
Nothing you can talk about. I gotcha. What'll it be?
The usual.
Coming right up.
Jones watched closely as Arnie carefully constructed a large sundae and bit his lip as the finished masterpiece arrived at the window.
Here you go. One cookies and cream, double delight with extra cookies. That'll be $3.50.
Here you go.
And here's your change. Thanks.
No, thank you.
Jones retired with his sundae to the tables and chairs that huddled under a series of big umbrellas along one side of Arnie's establishment. Settling in at his favorite spot, Jones stirred the chocolate cookie bits through the big mound of soft serve. When he was satisfied that they were uniformly distributed, he scooped up a big plastic spoonful.
Mmm,
Behind his dark glasses, the detective's eyes closed, and his poker face softened into a wide, boyish grin.
From the 1260 newsroom, this is Charles P. Irwin. Select areas of the Rocky Mountains continue to swelter in the midst of a record-setting heat wave and dry spell that has state smoke eaters jumpy. And University of Colorado meteorologists are describing as bizarre the localized effects of this dry spell, raising further questions about their possible connection to, quote, clusters of anomalous weather events of increasing intensity, unquote, currently being studied. Closer to home, one of our 1260 weather watchers has phoned in with a report, as yet unconfirmed, of a series of lightning strikes in the mountains west of El Dorado Springs. And this just handed me. This is an official notice of the emergency alert system. The Colorado State Patrol reports a series of wildfires now raging along a line stretching from a mile south of Boulder to State Route 72. Routes 128, 93, and 72, west of US 36, are being closed to all but emergency vehicular traffic, and an evacuation has been ordered for El Dorado Springs. We now return you to our regularly scheduled programming.
Detective Jones looked down at his unfinished sundae and frowned.
Fire. It would have to be fire.
He tossed his sundae cup in a nearby trash can and sprinted behind the soft serve stand. There, confident nobody was looking at him, he faded from sight. Hidden beneath an aura of invisibility, he began to transform. He grew taller. His hair melted into his scalp. His brow bulged. Even his clothing began to change. The dark suit flowing into cape, trunks, and boots. In seconds, the guise of Detective Jones was gone. In his place stood the Martian Manhunter. He launched himself into the sky, heading northwest toward El Dorado Springs. He flew invisibly through the western skies, up into the higher elevations, where a vast line of fire and smoke rose heavenward. The Martian swallowed hard, fighting off a wave of nausea. Fire was his Achilles heel, a psychological vulnerability that fed a physiological one. If he let the fear get to him, he would weaken and burn. Still, he was a manhunter, sworn to act as a guardian of his people. His home planet Mars was a dead world, his native people long since perished. He had lived on this good Earth, in this area, and among these people for many years. This was his home now, and these were his people. He felt a responsibility toward them. And so, he forced himself onward, past the caravans of evacuees, past the homes scattered among the trees, past the fear. Onward he flew, into the fire zone itself. He hurled himself bodily at a stand of trees. A score of the driest ones were uprooted in a matter of minutes. John split one huge, bone-dry tree trunk down the middle with his bare hands and then flew on, holding it out before him like the blade of a plow, scraping the forest floor bare. As fire crews moved into the area, they found a wide fire break already carved between the threatened homes and the conflagration. The crew chief looked around in astonishment.
Huh? It looks like someone beat us this section.
My apologies. When I arrived, I thought it best to remove a fuel source from the path of the fire.
Well,
I am the manhunter.
Well, we're glad you're here. This is perfect. It would have taken us hours to clear a break like this.
Is there anything more that I can do?
Just keep on doing what you're doing, brother. You take out the big stuff and we'll follow behind to clear the underbrush. This is a bad fire now, but it doesn't have to stay that way.
I shall.
The manhunter threw himself back into his work. In minutes, the firebreak was longer by a mile. If he kept his distance from the fire, he knew he could continue to aid in fighting it. All he had to do was refuse to weaken.